the worst thing that could happen is I'm still in a band with three of my best friends. You know, I'm 45 years old. I'm playing short, fast, loud punk music with my friends and having a good time doing it.
When I don't think I can ever see myself not being in a band. Now, that's you know, from probably day one when we did play there at Lucy's, just to a packed house and all the fans just screaming, "Shtuck it, shtuck it, shtuck it."
By the time Lucy's opened, punk and the do-it-yourself culture was almost two decades old. What started in the early 70s as a rebellious and revolutionary counterculture movement had gone mainstream, making its way from the squatters in London piercing bodies with safety pins to the suburban kids in every town USA using Manic Panic to dye their hair. And for the kids who lived in those suburbs, even if they didn't want to wear the spikes or have the hot pink hair, they could take from punk the idea that if you wanted to create something, like, say, rock music in a band with your friends while you were still in high school, you didn't have to wait for anyone to give you permission. You could simply do it yourself, which is exactly what Mike Shepherd and Jeremy Fry did 30 years ago. For Mike and Jeremy, the DIY meant borrowing rock and roll instruments from the attic where their high school band stored equipment, recording themselves using this thing called a Singalodeon, which was a cassette tape combo boombox and karaoke machine thingy, and making homemade videos that poked fun of the sellouts who had invaded MTV. More than 30 years later, Jeremy and Mike are still playing rock music together at clubs in and around Nashville, but their first show was at Lucy's Record Shop when they were around 16 years old.
My name is Mike Shepherd.
Hi.
Hello.
That's good.
And I'm a Lucy's kid.
My name is Jeremy Fry, also Lucy's kid.
I was born here, but I moved away in the 80s, spent the 80s in the Midwest, and came back in 91. And the first, not lunchroom friend, but like friend outside of school that I made was Jeremy. We were in concert band together in the eighth grade. I was the first trombone, which is to say the only trombone. And Jeremy was tenor sax. He sat directly in front of me. And I remember the first time I laid eyes on him, he had purple Skids overalls on.
Actually, that's incorrect.
Okay, were they white?
They were checkerboard, white and black Skids overalls. Okay. One.
I remember the one shoulder
one
down.
One strap up, yeah. One shoulder down. Yeah. Jerry Lawler style.
And he had a rat tail. I don't know if we've ever talked about this, but I think mm-hmm. that you, as the tenor sax player, were playing some of the trombone parts.
Absolutely.
Because there were no trombones in the band until I joined the band. So it was a chilly relationship, obviously, very competitive.
That's how those parts work.
Yeah. But one day in study hall, when our band director called out sick, new kid, no friends, and we were in study hall, and I noticed that he had a stack of X-Men comics under his chair, and I had a stack of X-Men comics under my chair, and we started passing notes about X-Men comics. A fast
and
friendship
ladies and
was
gentlemen,
born.
That is the nerdiest thing that you will hear.
I'm sure it's probably going to get a little bit nerdier than that. I think we can get there.
We can get there, yeah.
I'm competitive. That's a challenge. Yeah. That gauntlet's been laid down.
So, that's how we got together. Mm-hmm. And then
I taught him to throw a Nerf football.
Yeah. The first time I threw and caught a football was in Jeremy's front yard. And I still remember to this day my dad pulling up and sitting in the car to pick me up. And I think he might have sat in the car for like 5 minutes, maybe crying.
Because he was so happy.
Because if you threw me a ball, I would throw my hands in front of my face to make sure it didn't hit my face and not catch the ball. That's how I played catch with my dad. And I think that seeing that I had a sports friend was very exciting to him.
And do you remember it the same way?
Absolutely. We've been telling this story verbatim for 30-ish years.
I mean, we probably didn't tell it in 31 years.
Pretty close. Yep. So I was born and raised here. Never left. Never had to come back. I was into music pretty early on. My parents were pretty young when they had me. So I grew up listening to, luckily, super cool music, B-52s, Stones, Beatles, prog rock, pretty much any genre. My parents were way, way into it. And they had a friend named Mark Seymour, who played drums for a Nashville band called the Dremels. And so one of my earliest memories, I think I was maybe like 5, my dad took me to see them play. So I was like, oh yeah, that's what I want to do. So of course I played saxophone mm-hmm. in the band, mm-hmm. logically. But Mark gave me a drum set when I was like 4 or 5 years old. That little blue bop kit, it was super tiny. Still have it. But I was just always into music and stuff. Joined the band when I was in 5th grade or whatever it was. Played saxophone. Stole that drum set in 92 and started teaching myself how to play to the White Album. So as much as I want to claim influences, it's probably Ringo Starr.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when did you realize, like, okay, well, music is now going to become something more important than just junior high band?
So our, in high school, because, you know, I had only been in town for 9 months by the time I started my freshman year in high school. So I had my middle school friends, which were, I mean, it's primarily Jeremy and then like a couple other friends from bands, and I had been in the school play, so a couple friends from that. But like I met day one, 9th grade, Ryan Shogren, who was this tall, blonde dude from Wichita, Kansas, and we were all weirdos. And so our friend circles kind of very quickly started orbiting each other. And then like as corny as it is, it was that fucking Nirvana record. Specifically, Ryan, I think, switched from piano to guitar around the time of that emergence of punk rock records on the radio again.
That would have been 91.
Yeah, 91, 92. So
summer of 91.
He started taking guitar lessons and we would hang out while he played guitar. And then eventually Jeremy borrowed some drums from, was it Matt Glassmeyer?
We're going to put some quotations around borrowed. I borrowed drums from McGavick High School. And then they just took a really long, long time to get back to the attic.
The way I recall it is Ryan started playing guitar. Jeremy, about 6 months later, maybe, started playing drums separately, just unrelated. And then they started playing together. And I was in the band. I just didn't play a rock and roll instrument. So I would hang out. I would sing on some songs. I would play recorder, trombone, keyboard, whatever dipshit instrument I knew how to play that was inappropriate for a rock setting, I would play. And there was another guy, he had a bass guitar and he was hanging out and they were playing together. And I was there. I was hanging out. I was in the band. I was holding the video camera. I was operating the tape machine, whatever. And then there was one day, there was a song that the band had written that I sang on. And they were like, we should shoot a music video for the song, which of course is just us in Jeremy's parents' living room playing the song. And Ryan and Jeremy, as I recall, said, Mike, you know, Andrew is so good with the video camera. He's such a good videographer, and you're not great with the video camera. Why don't you play bass on this one just for the video, and we'll see how it goes. And like, I had been playing bass a little bit. And I was like, okay, so they showed me the notes, just the notes on the bass for that song, because I had never played bass on this particular song. So I played bass and sang on videotape the very first time that I played bass and sang with the band. And then from that point on, as I recall, basically they just stopped inviting Andrew to band practice and I was the bass player in the band.
Yep, yep. Sounds like an that is that is story. That is pretty much correct, yeah. Because I think it more morphed from us being kind of like movie nerds / playing around with video cameras and whatever. Mm-hmm. Like we did all that stuff through high school, and we were we're doing kind of a mockumentary of 120 minutes. So this day was literally us doing a Evan Dando interview.
There were
wigs involved.
The costume changes, wigs.
I had a
wigs.
Lobster hat on. I had duct electrical tape over my neck. Like, yeah. It's a whole thing. I have the whole thing on VHS.
There's an interview segment where I'm interviewing Ryan and Jeremy in the character of Louis Largent, who at that point was the host of 120 Minutes. And for me, who had been watching 120 Minutes for fully 4 years by that point, sellout. You know, I knew a sellout when I saw one. So I put on a wig and did my imitation of Louis Largent interviewing Ryan and Jeremy.
And then we played this song.
And then we played the song, but I took the wig off and played bass.
Yeah. And so I was terrible. We were all terrible.
We were all terrible.
I'm left-handed. I was trying to play right-handed, but I started at every fill with my left hand, which any drummer out there is like, oh, nope, don't do that. So it was really, really bad. Everything was really terrible. But we just kept playing and doing it. Mike and Ryan would hang out. Ryan had a thing called a singalodeon.
Singalodeon.
And so they would take Beastie Boys, and not that I'm competitive or jealous, but I'm competitive and jealous. Yeah. So they would like get together, they would do these Beastie Boys raps, they would take and loop like instrumental sections of the song and do their own little verses and stuff. I was like, well,
you're giving us way too much credit. There was just an instrumental part in the song, So What You Want, and we did two verses over it.
It was pretty good.
The Singalodeon was a karaoke machine. It was a dual cassette deck with an 8-inch speaker in it and like two inputs.
It was very important for us.
So you could put something in the left side and hit play and put something in the right side and hit record. You had like a mic input or a guitar input, so you could plug stuff in or vocal mics in or guitars in.
You could lay stuff over it. Wow. It was good. It was good. The quality was pretty good. All on cassette tape.
Yeah.
Just bouncing that stuff back and forth.
Yeah, and that's how we recorded and demoed songs in that band, I think, through 1998.
It was forever.
We never had any other method except the singalodeon.
So it was like a slow burn, but you know, like, I was a fledgling drummer. Ryan was getting better guitar. Mike didn't even play bass yet.
And to be clear, as they were a band in the sense that like our friends would say, "I'm having a birthday party. Would you come over and play Stone Temple Pilots covers?" And we would say, "Okay." And like we would show up and play what covers we knew. And like I think we had one original.
I played at my girlfriend Shannon Netherton's birthday party. Mm.
How did you find Lucy's?
So as a kid, would read the newspaper, the Nashville Scene, the Tennessean. I was raised as a newspaper reader by my father, and I thank him for that. And I would read the music listings, and I would see bands I was aware of listed as playing the Migraine Matinee at Lucy's on a Sunday afternoon. And we were a church-going family, and it just didn't seem like something I ever felt... I mean, it wasn't something I ever felt comfortable asking my parents to do, driving me down... you know, down to the seediest part of downtown Nashville for a punk rock show in the middle of the day. It was like, well, that show would be great to go to, but I can't go to that. And it was just that hang up that I had the whole time where I was just like, I'm not allowed to go to that show. I don't know why. I know, you know, I didn't have a car. I didn't have any money. So
how and you
I...
never asked. And you never tested it.
Literally never asked.
You're a rule follower.
I
so much so.
Yeah,
that's a whole another podcast. Yeah, right now.
I never went. So I remember reading listings of shows, you know, Hammerhead and Hoover and bands playing down there that I would love to see, but just didn't think that I was allowed to ask to go down there. And somewhere down the road, I don't know when this was, and you might know. I should have asked you because now that I know you have all the calendars.
Yeah.
Mary,
yeah.
By the way. There was Stone
Deep. That was
aggressive.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what that was. That wasn't anything real.
Let's dial it back a little bit.
Keeping secrets. No, I'm just kidding. My recollection is that my sister's best friend had a crush on the guitar player in a band. And they were going to the show, and there was so much of me getting out of the house and going to shows at that point was my parents saying, take your brother with you to my sister. That's what it took, because otherwise I would just sit at home and read comic books and listen to tapes and play video games, and I was happy with that. So getting me out of the house was, I have to imagine that was not by anyone's choice except my parents saying, get him the fuck out of the house for 6 hours, please. So we went down there, and I had heard about Lucy's, and it was a big deal for me because I've been reading about all these shows, and I was like, this legendary space. And I, you know, walked in there, went to the back room, and you know, the band that they had gone to see played, and they were fine. I don't remember anything about them. It's not an especially memorable band. But the band that played after them, the band that was headlining that show, was Stone Deep. And as a 15-year-old kid in 1993, that was a big fucking deal to see, like, some professional musicians competently marrying the worlds of hard rock and hip hop. Can you imagine such a thing? I mean, I've heard tapes by bands like Rage Against the Machine, but
they didn't do it first.
Was that your first All Ages show?
My first All Ages show was the 91 benefit at 328 Performance Hall. I walked into 328, the house lights were up. Ryan and Jeremy are in the crowd. There's toilet paper.
There's toast. There's toilet paper.
Everywhere. Like, the place
there's,
is completely
there's everything
wrecked
that you could imagine being thrown from a stage everywhere. And that was the Fun Girls. And he had just missed the Fun Girls.
I had just missed the Fun Girls.
And I mean, it was transformative. Like, it was
so these two dudes, like, the next birthday party we played, before we went on, we put the Fun Girls tape in the boombox and made everyone listen to that High Doll 7-inch. And then we played. But it was like, they were like our Beatles. Like, they were like...
huge.
Big, big deal. Like, big deal for us. And so, like, so then we knew that they played at Lucy's. And so the next time they played at Lucy's, we were there.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how we got into that.
Started really going there. But, I mean, I think...
honestly, Mary, the big thing was that some of us started getting driver's licenses.
Mm. Yeah, I was very young for my grade, so I couldn't drive till I was a senior in high school. So I would just be...
and I just didn't bother to get my license until I was 17. So, like, Ryan had a car, and he would take us places. And we would... and that was a new thing.
My thing was, I saw that 91 benefit... and I swear to, I mean, like, I cannot overstate how important, and I hope Kat's listening, and Donnie and everybody, Troy, Chris,
yeah.
Fun Girls was it, man. Like, that was the shit. That was, I was all the way in. Like, mind blowing.
The excellence of performance, the songwriting, the presentation. Mm. Like, you can find YouTube videos of the Fun Girls playing out of town, and that's one thing. Like, there's a video of them playing someplace, like in Alabama and everyone in the bar wants to kick their asses. But, like, this was fucking home field advantage. These dudes were coming in and dressing, you know, in full drag and in different themed costumes in some cases. And each night there was something different that they threw into the crowd.
It was so awesome. And for me, like, playing drum, like, Chris is a phenomenal drummer. Yeah, like, I mean, incredible drummer. So, of course, you know, again, I'm slightly competitive. So I was like, well, I gotta like, get that good. You know, I mean, like, he was insane. And all of them were just insane. And it was just so good. Everybody had their own little, you know, attitude and shtick and stuff. It was just, at least I was at that time, a big pro wrestling fan. So, mm-hmm. like, you know, the gimmick was a thing, and just their stage presence was a thing, and the energy, and just the crowd, and it was always packed, and it was awesome. So that 91 benefit was sort of the springboard into us going there more, and, you know, that was sort of the gateway drug.
Yeah. And Jeremy, you may be able to answer this question for me. I don't recall the reason why we attempted to make our first tape, and I'm wondering if it was so that we could have a demo to bring down to Lucy's to try to book
I think
show.
It was. So as I mentioned before, my parents were good friends with some musicians at the time. So I think I'd maybe talked to them, or we had talked about trying to record something, and so they talked about our good friend and original engineer Larry Mars.
Larry Mars is basically the George Martin of Stuttgart.
The fact that
we came out of the gate with tapes that sounded like they had been recorded by professionals.
He had a studio in his house, big board, super great. He was awesome. He was a cool dude. He let three just snot-nosed 16 and 17-year-old assholes take over his house.
Three fully entitled, gifted children.
Oh, God. Just like, so bad. It was so bad. I feel so bad. We drove him to Christianity in ways that nobody will ever know. Bless him. It's our fault. Sorry, Larry. But so we went in.
Or you're welcome.
Yeah. Or you're welcome.
Things are working out great.
So we went in, we recorded there, and we had this tape. I remember playing it for our band directors. I remember, Nola Jones.
That tape.
Seminal.
You mean your high school band directors?
Correct.
You're still playing in high school bands.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you're talking to an all-state tenor saxophone player two times over.
What?
Yeah. I mean, come on. That's my major instrument.
You're talking to a second band at Festival Winds of Percussion in 1993 over here. Come on.
Come on, that's what we do. Yeah. We're multifaceted.
And when you brought the tapes to your band directors?
Well, the fact that we didn't play to a click track and I couldn't keep time at the time. I think that was the first lesson as a band director now myself. Lying to kids sometimes is a positive thing.
I remember mixing that first tape and Larry being like, off to the races.
Yeah, like, that's going to be my bad. That's why I'm so adamant. I will always play with a click. Yeah. But no, man, they were super supportive. Positive, super supportive, totally into it.
So we brought the tape down to Lucy's. Donnie called and said, hey, I've got your tape. Would you guys like to play a show? And I
hell yes, we would.
My heart stopped. And I was like, I'd love to. What date do you have? And he said, October 28th. And I said, that's great. That's my birthday. That was my 18th birthday.
What?
October 28th. And I looked at the calendar and we had a football game that night. And it was senior presentation night. It wasn't just any football game.
I think we probably recreated like the scene out of that thing you do when their songs play on the radio. Just us being able to even get the offer to play at Lucy's was like, we probably ran down like Andrew Jackson Boulevard or Lebanon Road with my shirt off.
The main thing I remember is that Donnie said that you'll have a 45-minute set. And
we can't do that.
And what I thought at the moment was, man, we've got to fill 45 minutes to the nose, like on the nose. We only had 7 songs. And they were
better write some more.
2.5 minutes long. So we worked up, I think, like 3 covers.
Yeah.
And wrote like maybe one more song because we knew for sure we had to play for a full 45 minutes.
And we did not want to screw this opportunity up. Like it was not. This was it. This was the chance.
Years later, I figured out that it was a 45-minute limit, not a 45-minute minimum.
Hilarious.
So
the amount of record scouts that were going to be in the in the crowd that night, we had to really bring it because this was our chance. This was our chance to get signed.
We worked up those 7 songs that we had, and I know we played UMass by the Pixies. We played, I think we played Tourette's by Nirvana.
That seems about right.
And was there another cover or just those two?
It's possible.
But I think we wrote one more song and played 2 covers, and we always played a cover at Lucy's, every show we played. That was like a tradition we started that night. We played Teenager in Love by Johnny Rivers at one show, I remember.
Nope.
No, we did.
I know we did, but I'm saying nope to that now. If I could just go back and make some decisions with my now brain back then.
That show we played, the amp I was playing through was a keyboard amp that we had, again, borrowed from the high school band.
Quote.
Air quote.
I think it still had the tag on it. From like where they were like borrowing it from a music store, and I had kept it. I just took it home and was playing bass through this keyboard amp, the borrowed GTX bass, and then there was a happy birthday balloon tied to my amp for the show, and we were these sweet floppy-haired dudes and baggy button-up
shirts. We looked like we should be the house band of 90210. Like all three of us had a butt cut where the hair was down to like our ears if we were lucky, and we were using Aveda pomades to just get it so right.
Very
with a nice
excellent
little
product.
Sheen.
Yeah, we had great hair product.
I did own my own drum set by that point. It was a very sun yellow Pearl Export.
What was the crowd like?
My parents loved it.
Yeah.
That crowd was packed. That was probably the best and worst thing that ever happened to me my whole entire life because it was packed. Like it was slammed.
Yeah.
And it was awesome. And they cheered for us and I was hooked and it was like I was addicted. Yeah. And
girls we knew from high school were at the show. Strangers we didn't know were at the show doing a mosh pit in front of us, just like on MTV.
What?
But then also flipping us off when we were playing our slow songs.
It was fantastic.
It was.
I mean, every single bit of it was.
It felt like a tightrope walk. Like
glorious.
It was this. You know, this.
And we should have been somewhere else. And
yes,
we were there.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
And playing hooky from a marching band.
No. We did it right. I went to Mr. Jeff Beckman, bless his heart. Like, this was a hardcore Southeast, one of the best in the entire country marching band, and you did not miss at all ever. And so we went in, I asked him, and he was like, "Well, you know, okay."
Yeah.
Oh shit, he said yes.
It was
so
huge.
It was big. So we did it right. We didn't like skip out on anything, you know, because we followed the rules.
We are. We follow us, fastidiously.
We had to be good. We had to be really good. But it was awesome. I mean, it was like the night of our lives.
And it was your birthday.
It was my birthday. It was my 18th birthday. So again, like, kind of a late bloomer to the punk rock scene, because like, I was 17, he was 16 when we started becoming regulars at Lucy's. And so we only had that kind of 1 year period.
It was a truncated little window for sure.
Where for 1 year we played every 2 months. And that was the other thing. Is like, Donnie would call every 2 months to book a show. And he had that thing like, you don't want to have the same bands playing every week. You don't even want to have the same bands playing every month. Got to have that 2 month buffer, which was brilliant, because you're talking about teenagers. So you're getting that, like, they'll go see every show, but not if it's every week.
Yeah.
You know, so like, you know, our next show was December 94. I just off the top of my head, December 1994.
Can we edit out the sound of pages turning, please?
We just kept y'all kept asking us back to play, which is another thing. Like, I at least didn't realize at the time that that's just, you got bands that didn't completely suck and you just had them back to play shows. Like, that's,
yeah.
Like, we thought we had passed the audition and we were in, which I guess was the case.
I think that's actually probably the case. Like, we filled a little role or void. Like, we were different than
others. From what I remember, too, is that you kept getting better.
Well, yes.
I feel like if you listen to that first tape, which you can, I put it all on Bandcamp last year for one of those Bandcamp Fridays, and you can listen to the progression. We got better.
The band is Stuck It. I don't think we've even mentioned
the name
of the band. Which, by the way.
The band's name, The Kings of Leon.
I'm Jerry Leon, the drummer for Kings of Leon. This is my brother, Donnie Leon.
I'm Henry IV of Leon.
Yes, we were in a band called Stuck It. Why? Because that, unfortunately, is the best thing that we could come up
with.
Did that come from?
It was an exclamation that Ryan made one day in an Algebra 2 class, specifically. I remember he was sitting in class one day and just went, "Stuck It!" Like that. And
That's it. We got it.
Well, you know,
any other names that you were thinking about at that time?
Yeah, a bunch. Something with an eyeball, baby with an eyeball in its head. I mean, it was just the dumbest.
Orgasm Smile was the one that I remember that just, I was like, I can't be
if
in
you
a
can
band
imagine,
with the name Orgasm.
If you can imagine.
Oh, my.
We're real followers. This is how not punk rock we were. Yeah.
Too provocative.
Yeah, Stuck It was actually the best option. As much as it depresses me to say that, that's the fact. That is the truth.
So, do you, out of all the shows that you played, do you have a favorite?
That first one really sticks out. So
it was so cool. We played with Stone Deep.
We played with Stone
Deep,
which
I think for me was probably at least for me. All of these bands were even bigger than any big band at the time, any of the grunge stuff that was going on, because we could go see them.
We could go see them. We could talk to them.
We could talk to
them. You know,
they may be new. Like, we could play with it. Like, it was just that whole scene was so big for us. And it was, I mean, I was telling, I, you know, I don't know that. That I would still be playing drums, or that we would still be in bands, or even be in bands, if it wasn't for Lucy's or a place like that, And, you know, I don't think you can put any sort of quantitative price tag on that. Like, it was just so unique, you know. It was such a special little thing. Especially when there just wasn't any other opportunity like that.
There's
just
we played, the only place we played more often than Lucy's is it's a tie between the Donaldson High School gym, which was available to book for birthday parties, and the McGavick High School auditorium.
Like one time.
Twice, sir.
Oh, sorry. How many times we played Lucy's?
Multiple. No, I'm just saying it's second only to Lucy's.
Yeah.
Is Donaldson High School gym.
I think somewhere between 10 and 12 is the number that you play.
I like it.
Lucy's.
The big one for me was the end of, like, the summer after our senior year. We played the Back to School Bash. Mm. We headlined the Back to School Bash.
What?
Which was, I mean, we were headlining.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we had a couple of that, like, headlining slots, I don't remember them. So, I don't remember.
I think at some point you just kept headlining, right? Unless it was a traveling
band.
Once we
sort of transitioned into that, which I don't know what that says for Lucy's or us, but
like I said, you kept getting better. There was that getting better thing.
Well, yeah, this
we
sauce
kept
is
covering Nirvana. I mean, at least according
to the calendars, by our third show, we were headlining at Lucy's.
The meteoric rise to the top.
That Sauce to Still show, I remember because I got that shirt that I wore a lot. And
what show was that?
Sauce to Still was the name of the band.
I know there was a good show we couldn't play because I broke my arm.
Yeah.
If this is going out publicly, Reed Stevenson broke my arm.
Oh, boy.
No, he didn't. But
he's going to hear this.
It's a great joke.
But no, the Back to School Bash, it was us and Daphne's Operation and Logic Bomb and Uncle Daddy.
Oh.
And for us, I was a Daphne's Operation fan.
Yeah.
I had tried to join Logic Bomb. I pulled a piece of paper off the wall at Lucy's when they were looking for a bass player and called them and talked to them.
Always one foot out the door, this one.
Apparently.
Yeah, tell
you were going to play looking in for the addition next to Stuck
In
it,
addition,
right?
Yes.
Yeah,
no,
of course.
I was not leaving.
But what happened? Did they just not
I talked to Jim Velasic on the phone for a long time, and they had already lined up another bass player, but we talked again for probably 2 hours.
Please tell me it was Jim.
But that was a big one for us because, like, A, that was, it was like our swan song because we were all going off to college. I was going to Murfreesboro. Jeremy's going to Knoxville. Ryan was going up to New York. So, like, we didn't know what was going to happen after that. You know, that might have been our last show.
It was uncertain times for Stuck It.
And we had just released our third cassette in a year. But no, I mean, it was. We were 18. We were going off to school. We didn't know, you know, like.
I was 17 because y'all are older than me.
That's true. But we were going off to school. We didn't know what was going to happen. And so that was a BFD. And also we had our best tape yet.
The best cassette yet.
The seminal classic, Another Ugly Baby.
If you thought our band name was awesome. I mean, wait till we run down the names of our cassette releases.
What better time than to do them now?
Man, I don't even know what they're called. There was a Toothy in there somewhere.
Toothy, yeah. The first one was called Stuck It. The colloquial name was Limit Calls to Nuts.
I don't even feel like that's true.
That's true.
Another Ugly Baby.
Another Ugly Baby was number three. Number four was it's kind of our nadir. It was called It's Doomsday for the Skull.
Oh, It's Doomsday for the Skull.
That was our first.
Bringing the heat. We're laying down the hammer.
That was our long player. Also, that was the last thing that Larry did with us because he didn't, after that.
And he was done. I think he was probably going through some stuff. I think we blame ourselves a little bit more than we probably should for the 100%. Larry's
Stuck It did not. Stuck It had nothing to do with Larry's life decisions. Larry is a grown-ass
man. The guy
man.
That we saw like once every year and a half, maybe 2 years.
We saw him 4 times a year until we didn't.
Yeah.
But he
found the Lord and
we came in there with that record, and that was our first tape back after a year at college. Our minds had been expanded.
The concepts were more mature.
More mature. So, concepts like having sex with girls, doing drugs.
I've never done any of that.
Yeah.
So much for rule following.
Boy,
look at this guy over here.
Well, and you know, I tell you what, I sent it to one of our dear friends and big fans, and I asked her what she thought, and she said, I stopped after this particular song because it contained the line, I was her demon pal, she was my semen gal.
That's Ryan's fault.
And where she is now, I just don't give a shit because I'm still here.
I mean, come on. That's heavy.
Do you guys remember anything that you would consider your favorite thing that you bought there, like a record or a zine or...
I bought a Johnny Quest t-shirt. It was orange. I cannot remember the band whose shirt that was.
I still own, for sure, my favorite record I ever bought there, which was the second Brainiac LP, the Banzai Superstar.
Oh, God.
And again, I went to see the Fun Girls because they were opening up for Brainiac. CD. And
I saw that show. You know what? Maybe that was the best show I saw there.
Maybe. That first, the first Brainiac show, but it was the first one I saw.
Maybe that was the best show. That was, like, transformative.
Yeah.
That was insane.
Yeah. Like, the costumes, the musicianship, the fact that, that Timmy was singing through a synthesizer sometimes, and other times he's playing guitar, and, like, John Schmersal was playing that fucking weird detuned guitar, and it was just, like, it was insane. It was mind-blowing.
I feel like the crowd, they weren't doing anything except, like, jaws to the ground sort of deal. It wasn't like an aggressive, you know, we're in the pit or anything. It was just like, oh man, this is next level.
Yeah,
next level good.
That show, and honestly,
we saw They Might Be Giants there.
That was the show for me. I was about to mention that show because
we were right up front. We sat there forever.
Do you know why? Because we showed up there at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
I absolutely remember.
And I sat on the stage. I brought a book and I showed up at like 3 o'clock.
I think I met you a little bit later, but we had that whole little front.
I sat on the stage
area staked
and
out.
Just waited. Murdered Minority. Mm. Like, which if you look at that band, like, you know, John Sewell is fucking running Wedgwood Houston now. Like, he's beta mayor of Nashville. And I say beta in terms of secondary and not in any incel sense, but like you know, if you look at bands like Brazen Youth, where like From Ashes Rise came out of that band and, you know, dominated fucking
Dallas. You know what my favorite show memory for Lucy's was
the last
you know
show, right?
The best show that I ever saw, and the thing that I when I think about Lucy's, the thing that comes to my mind first is that Last Finger Hut show, and Dallas throws up and his pants fall down at the same damn time. What? And I'm standing right by Brooksy, and he like goes backstage. It was incredible. That happened.
Wait, like literally threw up?
They were throwing down. It was the Last Finger Hut show. He's cranking down and like the guitar player of all guitar players. Mm-hmm. Like, and it was so hot. Everybody was so fired up. Everybody was just like into it, you know. And it was just, and it was, so, it was throwing down. It was just the end. He leaned over. He threw up. But somehow, at the same exact time, with his little skinny butt, his little skinny little hips, his little skinny ass, his little bony legs, who I love, his pants fall right down. And so he's standing there in his underwear. He's just thrown up, and he's still playing the shit out of the guitar. Still playing the shit out of the guitar.
Oh.
And then he like just goes backstage. I look at Brooke, and then she goes backstage. It was just that's it. Like, those things happen there, and they couldn't happen anywhere else.
Teenagers having the biggest rock experience that
Troy,
they could ever imagine.
Troy with his balloon boobs.
Yeah.
That's how I was judging a marching band contest one time, and I was walking up to go to the press box to judge the contest.
Yeah.
And I looked over to the left, and I was like, you played in Fun Girls. You played bass in Fun Girls from Mount Pilot. And he looked at me, and he was like, what? And it was Troy. So I guess his like daughter was in, you know, like the color guard of a band or played clarinet in a band or whatever. I was like, you played bass in Fun Girls from Mount Pilot. And he was like, oh my God. I was like, I played in a band called Stuck. And he was like, nah. And I just went up to the thing and judged, you know.
But no, like one of the biggest, like, as an adult, like, it's so fucking cool to be, you know, to now think of you as a friend, Mary, and think of Donnie and April as friends. And, you know, think of Troy and Kat and Chris. And
we often threaten to cover I'm Gonna Hold a Grudge.
Mm-hmm. Oh, do it.
You're talking the wrong guy.
The problem is that Jeremy can't play drums and sing it at the same time. And then
no, Kat comes up and sings.
Yeah.
I just play the drums. Oh, yeah. But I also that's can't play hard. Chris's part. But I'm working on it.
Yeah.
I'm practicing.
What happened to Stuck It?
We continued to play. We broke up, I believe, summer of 97. No, well, we played summer of 97. We did not record anything that summer. That's the one year that we didn't record anything as a band. Jeremy and I recorded a couple songs that we had been working on in Ryan's absence for him to...
With the bass player for the Dead Deads.
That's right. Yeah, Mavis Turner was our... I mean,
name drop. AKA I'm name dropping everybody. Calling everybody, I'm name dropping everybody.
She was a big fan of the band and would come to practice sometimes and hang out.
Yeah.
And she sang on one song and she came to the studio and hung out at Pete Cummings' house and like we recorded these two songs.
It's fantastic.
It lost
forever. Gone forever.
I can hear them if I can hear them right now in my head, but I will
never.
Yeah, it's good.
They're really good.
It's good stuff. And so we tried to get Ryan to play that stuff, and he wasn't into it. And then we were like, you know what? Let's record these songs that we've got written. And we went over to Pete Cummings' house and we recorded them. Pete mixed them. We got them mastered.
Wow.
And burned to a CD, and we never put it out because we were never going to play another show. And so, yeah, again.
That sounded really good.
It sounded great. It's probably the best stuff we've done, honestly.
Is that on Bandcamp?
It's on the Bandcamp. Okay. Yeah, it's all there. But it's...
We played at the Pop Roxy House.
Our Pop Roxy House in Murfreesboro with our dear friend's wife beater. Hmm. Well, basically, like that, after that summer, Ryan and Jeremy graduated from college. I did not because I wanted to stay in college longer.
And we had moved on to other bands by that point.
Sure.
As well.
Yeah.
So
I was in the Shakedown Cruise. Jeremy was in the Shakedown Cruise sometimes.
And Shibboleth started.
It was just kind of we were
moving on.
Yeah.
Ryan was doing his thing. He was acting.
The big thing was Ryan stopped coming home summers. Like we would all come home summers to stay with our parents. And then the summer of 98 was the last summer when everyone did that. And so Ryan stopped coming back after that. And Jeremy got his job at his school, and we started other bands and just kind of kept going, you know.
And that's just it. You kept playing, though.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yep. So Apollo Up was the next incarnation.
Well, so 98 was the Shakedown Cruise, and then Ohio Casualty Group was the next band that I was in with Jay and Bo. And then Shibboleth was after Ohio Casualty Group split up, and Jeremy had been playing with a guy named Dan in a band called The Champions. And we just, Bo and I just invited ourselves to join their band. And it was really good for a while until it wasn't. And then we just stopped playing. And it was, you know, the
things are on their course.
Yeah. And then, after Shibboleth broke up, there was about a year where I wasn't playing with anybody. I don't know. Were you playing with Tracy DeLong?
Was that then?
Yeah. So Jay and I, the year of 2001, I was not in a band. It was the first time since 1993 that I had not been playing in a band. And I met my now wife and had a lovely life. And my guitar sat on a stand in my bedroom and I never touched it. And we started playing again with me and Jay and Dylan and Jeremy. And that was a thing. Wrote a couple of songs, never played any shows. And then... Jeremy McCall. And then Jeremy Fry and Jay Phillips and I started playing together and writing songs as Apollo Up, and that was the next like long lived band, like the band that lasted longer than a year. Mm-hmm. And we played from 2002 to 2008 consistently.
9, 10 inconsistently.
And you put a bunch of stuff out as Apollo Up too.
We had three records.
Three things,
As Apollo Up was trying to break up. Sorry, that's the wrong way to put it. We were trying to keep the band together, but we couldn't. Like it was
life
just,
was getting in the way.
A lot of logistical issues.
Yeah.
I think Apollo Up just kind of ran its course.
Ran its course.
I mean, that's just the most honest.
But there's a thing new thing say. Now, there and is. I guess it's not that new, it's not. Right?
Like the longest band we've ever been.
Is it really?
Yeah. Tower Defense is the band.
How
we're
did
in
that
now.
Start out? Because your lovely wife is in that band too.
That's true. So Sarah and I had played together in Short Ropes with Rachel Velasic and Curry May. But then that band split up because one of the guitar players had to take a different job where he couldn't come to practice anymore. And so
and one moved.
And then so we worked as a three-piece for a while as Bad Feeler. We played one show. We had three songs. And then that guitar player...
That might be the last time I took my shirt off at a show.
That guitar player moved to Arizona.
Oh my God, I totally forgot you used to do that all the time.
I always played drums with my shirt off.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, that Bo moved away and we were like, well, shit, all of our friends who play guitar are gone. We don't have any more friends that play guitar. But in the meantime, Jeremy was like, you know what we need to do is start a two bass band with Sarah. Because my wife, Sarah, plays bass and she's a great bass player. And so, you know, Jeremy's like, let's just do a two bass band with Sarah. There's been lots of great two bass bands. It'll be exciting and rock and roll and it'll be fun. We asked Sarah and she said, absolutely not. Under no fucking circumstances. That sounds like the dumbest shit I've ever heard.
And then I talked to her.
And then Jeremy talked to her.
Smooth talking and, Jeremy.
And talked her into it. And we, you know, we knew Curry. You know, we've been friends with Curry for years. And Sarah and I played with her in Short Ropes. And so we brought her in to kind of fill out the sound a little bit and be another voice in the band.
Did you have to convince her too?
No.
No, she was...
No,
Jeremy... They called me one night and they said, I said, hey.
Yeah.
Hey.
We might have had to convince Jeremy if he had had an opportunity to be convinced. However, we did not give him that opportunity.
No, they were just like, hey, listen, hey.
Here's what's going
to happen. They all had been out to a bar and they're like, hey, we got it. Hey, yeah. Let me tell you what's... This is it. And I was like...
But we, you know, it really did change the, you know, the palette that we had to work with. And so, yeah, we've been together for, we just passed 10 years since our first show. And aside from my occasional existential panics about still being a lead singer and lyricist in a band, which I just, like, white dudes playing rock music, there's enough of that. And that's part of my struggle in terms of, like, I don't want to be the fucking dude in the band anymore. I don't want to be the lead singer in the band. Like, women and non-white people and, like, queer people, like, that's who needs to be fucking screaming into microphones right now. And, like, that's who we need to be listening to right now. And so, like, that's why spaces like Lucy's and like Dark Matter and like, you know, like the Southern Girls Rock and Roll Camp, like, it's just to... Because it's not that there's people that don't want to make those sounds. It's the people, they don't know that they have that window to do it. They don't know they have the venue to do it. And so giving them that opening, giving them that venue and that opportunity to make those sounds, like, obviously, yeah, it was huge for us as teenagers in the 90s to come down to Lucy's and make our sounds. But, like, it's boring for middle-aged white dudes to be yelling into microphones at this point. Like, that's, you know, like, my struggle with lyrics is, like, I don't have fucking anything to say. Like, you know, like, what is my song about? Like, you know, like, well, we refinanced our mortgage, you know.
There's a lot of dust coming off that repaving at Briley Parkway.
Yeah, it's really affecting.
I got dust on my house.
What am I going to do?
That's
wash my car
in value.
Twice a month now? You know, like, that's, it's boring. It's
that property tax hike. Was substantial.
Property tax hike is substantial. Yeah,
there you go. Hey, it's a new song.
It affects my mortgage payment. It's not interesting thing. Like, there's the new punk rock that needs to be happening right now is, like, the young voices coming out. And so, like, spaces, again, like, Lucy's paved the way. Mary, you paved the way. You provided that space. And, you know, I don't know if you know that as much as you own that as much as you should, but
should,
like,
also get residual babysitting fees for a substantial amount of parents who dump their kids at Lucy's and let them, like,
I mean, what do you, $5 at a time, you know?
Like, I played a show when I was 16 years old,
right?
Or I guess had just turned 17 years old,
sure.
And I just think you can't undersell the opportunity that was afforded to us. A very, like, you look at us, you look at Beth from Forget Cassettes, you look at people who went through there who are still maybe doing that. If that opportunity wasn't there, I think about it often. I don't think that I would still be playing music the way I'm playing music without it.
Yeah. It was a place where any night you could go down there and see a show and know that you'd have at least one or two friends there that you could talk to. And if not, you just stand out on the sidewalk and make new friends, or sit on the couch and pet Lucy and Jack and just, you know, like, really, when I think about, like, the limited amount of time that Lucy's occupied on a calendar versus the outsized impact that Lucy's has had on the community, I think it's just remarkable. I don't think there's any other space that has that kind of footprint still, that has that kind of, you know, ripples and echoes out. Like, still to this day, 25 years later, we're still talking about it. We're still living it. We're still experiencing the effects of it. It's a big deal.
Thanks so much for listening. For more info about the Lucy's Memories Mike and Jeremy shared, as well as links to full versions of the music featured, visit the episode notes or go to lucysrecordshop.com. Many thanks to Michael Eads for his time and the use of his studio. Fun fact, Michael of Podcast Studio and We Own This Town fame is the same Michael of YK Records, who puts out music by Tower Defense and so many other great bands. As you can tell, Michael is a tremendous supporter of creators, and he just published the 300th episode of his podcast, also called We Own This Town, which features local music from Nashville and the surrounding areas. It's a weekly genre-bending gift of new musical treasures that Michael lovingly puts together each week. Here's just a little bit of his 300th episode.
Obviously, for the 300th episode, I wanted to do something special. I kept coming back to the idea of the Nashville community and how there's no single piece of the puzzle that makes Nashville's music scene so great. Yes, there are a mesmerizing amount of local bands all making fantastic songs, but their efforts are augmented by local record stores, local labels, local writers, local DJs, local producers, local promoters, local artists supporting other artists. There's a giant swirl of community helping one another, propping each other up. We Own This Town strives to be a part of that giant mechanism, but it doesn't work without everyone's absolute dedicated involvement.
Thanks again, Michael. This show is brought to you by Give 40 the Finger Productions and We Own This Town, a podcast network of original entertainment and documentary content. You can find more info at the official site at weownthistown.net or follow at We Own This Town on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you have any stories, pictures, or music you'd like to share from Lucy's, or have questions about the things that we covered or about things that we didn't cover, or maybe a suggestion about someone you'd like to hear on this podcast, reach out to at Lucy's Record Shop on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook, or email me directly at mary@lucysrecordshop.com. Thanks again for listening.